Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Will Schwalbe, whose book is titled The End of Your Life Book Club. Will Schwalbe is the former editor-in-chief of Hyperion Books, before that William Morrow, 20 years in the book business, also the founder and former president of a website called Cookster, and the co-author of a book called Send, Why People Email So Badly and How to Do It Better. So in essence, this is your first book.
Yes, it is. It is. It's my first book.
I know that what prompted you to write it was the death of your mother, and the two of you read books side by side during those 2 years, I think it was, when she was on chemo. Having never written a book, had you thought about writing books before?
I had. When I was in high school and college, I had the ambition, very common among people that age, of being a writer. Actually, at that time, I wanted to be a playwright, and I wrote a lot. But after a while, just felt that I wasn't sure I had anything I was really desperate to write about, and was very happy for 20-plus years helping other people tell their stories. And then this story came along, and I really wanted to tell this one. The first time the book occurred to me was when I was over at Mom and Dad's apartment and visiting with Mom, and it was a couple months before she died. It was a strange occasion. I'd gone over to sort of give her the big talk and tell her everything I wanted to say, and I found I wasn't able to. And then I meant to say, I love you, which I said like a lot of kids do in a sort of casual way at the end of phone calls, but I want to say it in a sort of big way. And I wound up saying, I'm proud of you, instead of I love you. All of a sudden this popped into my head. I said, I want to write something. I want to write something about you, about the conversations we've had, the books we've read. And my mother's immediate reaction was, oh, sweetie, don't be ridiculous. You don't want to do that. You have so much other things to write about. But the next day she sent me an email. And in that email was a list of all the books we'd read. And then a couple days later, she sent an email saying, don't forget to talk about the need for healthcare reform. And a couple days later, another one. So I started to think very seriously about doing what I said I was going to do in writing this book.
And that was 2009.
That was 2009.
There were, well, several issues to talk about here, one of which, of course, is the decision to focus it on this little mini book club. It's really more about dealing with the ravages of cancer by a family member.
It's about dealing with the ravages of cancer. It's about all that entails, all the issues it brings up. But it became for me very much a book about choices and about living and about why we do the things we do and how to live life and what I could learn from Mom. And books were such an important part of that, that we'd always look to books to sort of tell us how to live.
Your mom was an extraordinary woman. I mean, it seemed to me in reading the book, it's also, in a sense, though you don't want to get too much into it, in a sense, a mini-bio of her.
It is in many ways a mini-bio of her because I didn't want to just present her opinions. I wanted to present them in the context of the choices that she'd made in her life. So I talk about how she started life as an actress, and then she worked in theater for people like Irene Selznick and Rosalind Russell and Freddie Brisson. She was an educator. She was director of admissions at Harvard when I was growing up. And then she was in high school education. And then in her mid-50s, she discovered the cause of refugees and devoted the rest of her life to working on refugee issues, and actually was the founding director of something that's now called the Women's Refugee Commission.
And she spent how many months with your sister at a refugee camp in, Cambodia or Burma?
It was on the Thai-Lao border. Right. I'm working with Hmong refugees. That was 3 months that she was there. It's a funny story. A mysterious postcard arrived in the mail one day, and it said, my name is Sister Mater, and I'm a nun on the Thai-Lao border, and I need your help. And it resulted in a chain of events of my mother taking a leave from her job as head of a high school and moving to this refugee camp with my sister who had just graduated from college, and it changed their lives.
The oddest thing about that story is that somewhere on the bus, she remarked to your sister, on the bus going there, she remarked, you know, I never really checked out if this person exists.
Exactly. She took my college-age sister off to travel over dark roads in the back of a pickup truck, and my mother was terrified at that point, thinking, uh-oh, what if this is a scam? But it wasn't. It was a legitimate nuns, legitimate refugee camp.
Will Schwalbe, reading this book for me is difficult. As we're speaking now, my mom is going through chemo for two different kinds of cancer. The chemo is a lot milder than what your mother experienced, but it also, in September, put me in a place where they were getting chemo. There's nothing to do other than read, pretty much, when you're stuck either with someone in a chair or in a chair.
You can read. You can talk. People can listen to music if they like. But if you're a reader, if you're a lifelong reader, it actually gave us an incredible opportunity to talk about books and to read books without distraction.
Had you been doing this for years before, reading the same books and talking about them?
We'd always talked about books. We were very much people who always said, "What are you reading?" One of our big questions. And we also demanded of each other that we read the books we loved. So if I read a book that I loved, you know, I'd say, "Oh, Mom, you must read this." And if Mom read a book she loved, "You must read this." And must really meant must. We were very intent that everybody in the family read the books we love. So, for example, when I fell head over heels with A Fine Balance by Rohinton Mystery, everyone in the family had to read it. But it wasn't quite as formal as it became when we sat there, chemo treatment after chemo treatment.
Did you have any problems reading for pleasure when you were reading for work?
Yes. When I was working in book publishing, it was very, very hard to read for pleasure. And so one of the great ironies of quitting my job in book publishing, which I did a couple months after Mom was diagnosed, was for the first time in 20 years, I could read for pleasure. For me, it wasn't that I didn't take pleasure in the books that I was reading, but there's something about reading what you want when you want. So even if you're reading a book that you know is absolutely spectacular, if that's not the book you need or want at that moment, it's not quite pleasure.
Well, what I found is sometimes serendipity brings books to you. So I'm reading this book while my mom is in chemo.
Mm.
And that happens as well.
That happens as well. And that's actually, I'm a big believer in serendipity. One thing I talk about is I have a superstition that if I knock over a book in a bookstore, I must buy that book. That's the universe telling me, read that book. Whatever it is, if I bump into it, it's mine.
Well, I understand in writing this book, Will Schwalbe, I understand that it was pretty easy to write. You had your mom's blogs, and you were kind of talking to her in a way, and she was kind of answering in a way. You kind of knew what she would say. But writing about her death was difficult.
Writing about her death was very wrenching. I did have a great time writing most of the book. It was fun. I was talking to her, but when I got to the last section of the book where I had to really chronicle her death, I found it really tough. And what I tried to do, I can't remember what cop show it was just the facts, ma'am, just the facts, was that Dragnet. I tried to just put down as simply as I possibly could exactly what happened. And that was the only way I could do it.
So you tried to divorce yourself, your own mental issues from those moments.
Yes, I tried to just describe. I was a little divorced. It was then this happened, then that happened. It actually matched my frame of mind, because my frame of mind in those last couple of days especially, it was a surreal experience. It was an out-of-body experience for me. I was looking at my mother as she was dying, surrounded by all the books she loved, but I was also kind of looking at myself too. Maybe that's a coping mechanism.
You do make the point that what people don't realize is that the death watch is extremely tedious.
Yes, and I wanted to be really honest about that. That was a very hard thing to write, because you feel like it should be some kind of emotionally overwhelming experience suffused with the most powerful feelings you've ever had. But as I experienced it, and as my siblings did too, and so many people I've talked to, it's all that. And then that's 5 minutes have gone by, and you know you're going to sit there for another 55 minutes, and it's very difficult.
Let's talk a little about the book club, which is just a two-person book club, though occasionally other people might read those books. These books just happen to come across your paths, or one of you would say, "You have to read this book," and then each of you would read the book at the same time. Is that pretty much it?
That's pretty much it. We read the way people read. That's how we did it.
And so, some of the books, they ranged from high art to mysteries. Patricia Highsmith is in there, a couple of people I've interviewed, not her, obviously, a couple of people I've interviewed. Marilyn Robinson's Gilead.
Yeah, that was such an important book to us. So we read that. We read Russell Banks. We read Jhumpa Lahiri. We read Little Thomas Mann. We read The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson. We read a wonderful book called Girls Like Us, Sheila Weller's book about Carol King and Joni Mitchell and Carly Simon. Very eclectic list of books.
What I found interesting in the books that I've read is that your focus in the books was different. Your focus about Gilead is about the characters. When I talked to her, it was mostly about the notion of grace.
Yes. Well, my notion was about the characters. I'm an agnostic. My mother was a very devout Presbyterian. And that was a book that she purposefully, I believe, inserted into our little book club because it gave her the opportunity to talk about grace.
Speaking of that, there's kind of a gap there. Both your parents come from Jewish heritage, which means that you're Jewish in heritage, but not in religion. And you never talk about what made your mom Christian.
I was never entirely sure what made my mom Christian. As a young girl, she became a Christian. Her mother had at some point become a Christian, and I'm not sure when her mother became a Christian. The rest of the family remained being Jewish, and my mother became a devout Christian.
Well, what about the rest of your family now?
The family ranges from non-practicing Jews to, in the larger family, practicing Jews, Christians in one of my siblings, another agnostic in another. So we're slightly all over the map.
What's your dad?
Dad, I would describe as a non-practicing Jew who goes to church on Christmas and Easter.
Like you said, you're an agnostic now.
I'm an agnostic and somewhat of a lazy agnostic, which is that I really haven't given it as much thought as I probably should. It was interesting. My conversations with Mom wasn't trying to convert me. What she really wanted was the comfort for me that she had gained from the church. I also tell the story in the book about when we were growing up, we could go to any church we wanted as long as we went to a church. And I wound up at a Christian Science Sunday school for years, which I loved, absolutely loved. I chose it because the juice and cookies were the best, but stayed with it because it was a very warm place.
She read a lot of from a book called Daily Strength for Daily Needs.
Daily Strength from Daily Needs was a book she, in the last year and some odd of her life, kept by her side constantly. It was next to her in bed. It was in her handbag. It went with her to the hospital. It's a book from a Christian perspective, one page a day, Bible quote at the top, a little bit of verse, and a religious quote at the bottom. And it's a book that dates way back. It's in the public domain now. Her copy was a secondhand copy from the year she was born, 1934.
What was your mother's view? I know your parents were both strong progressive. I guess your dad's still alive, right?
Yes, my dad's still alive.
Your mom and your dad are both strong progressives. How did your mom in particular view the Christian evangelical movement in regard to her own religion?
My mother was part of that extraordinary tradition of Christians for Social Justice, and she really believed in that tradition, I guess, including people like William Sloan Coffin and people who had used Christianity to work for a more just, more fair society. But my mother was a very inclusive person, and she took the love message very seriously, and she did not view people who disagreed with her as enemies. She thought they were people who needed to be treated with love. She did have a couple of exceptions. Charles Taylor, the gentleman who destroyed Liberia and Sierra Leone, Mom confined to whatever circle of hell anyone might believe in. But in general, she tried to create real fellowship with Christians of all different walks. But she came from a very liberal, progressive Christianity.
You're listening to an interview with Will Schwalbe, whose book is titled The End of Your Life Book Club. I'm Richard Walensky. You mentioned in an afterword you could have talked about her adventures in Liberia, but chose not to keep the focus on the book club. What happened in Liberia with your mom?
Liberia was a country that she really fell in love with, and she went there many times. She went there when the country was truly a failed state, lawless war, and she just connected with the people. I tell in brief the story of a fellow named John Kermieu, wonderful refugee friend of hers who she helped come to the U.S., called her mom. We now call him brother. mom in her refugee work really believed that her job was to get refugee voices out into the world, not to speak for people, but to let them speak for themselves. So if I had more space and time, I would like to have presented more refugee stories.
I guess the only thing that bothered me is how guilty I start feeling about how little I've done when compared to someone like your mom.
I mean, I feel guilty sometimes about how little I do compared to mom. But mom, and it's a talk we had, and a very important one, really said to me that that isn't a particularly productive emotion, and the important thing was to do something. That if everybody did something, that was good. But the one thing that was not okay was to do nothing.
Your mother was also involved in something called the Afghan Library, which is supposed to open sometime in the near future?
That's right. Mom, in her travels as a refugee advocate, had met an extraordinary woman named Nancy Hatch Dupree. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Tony Kushner Homebody Kabul, but
it, yeah.
That's loosely based on the writings of Nancy Hatch Dupree, a woman in her 80s who, with her late husband, assembled a collection without parallel of 38,000 volumes on Afghan history. Nancy Hatch Dupree's dream was to build a national research center and library in Kabul. And mom decided, with whatever limited time she had left, this was going to be her last big thing, and she was going to help Nancy do it. And working the phones from chemo, she first raised $1 million to build the library. And then after she died, the U.S. government came in with $3 million more. So the building is built. They're putting in the shelves. And Afghanistan will have something it hasn't had since the Soviet invasion, a national library and research center.
Another element of the book is the love of literature and the notion that literature itself, reading, is important. And for me, doing what I do here, that of course is something inside me. Books are important. And I think your mom stressed that books were important. Most of what she read, though, was fiction rather than nonfiction. Why was that?
Mom loved fiction, and she felt that stories really are how we as people tell each other what's important to us, and that within the context of a story, you can learn so much of what you learn in nonfiction, but you can learn so much more. And she would look to authors like Jhumpa Lahiri, books like Unaccustomed Earth or The Namesake, and felt that after you read a book like that, you had a wonderful story, the prose is wonderful, it was a great experience, but you also ended a little more attuned to the lives of people around you. That when you looked at someone, for example, a recent immigrant to the country, if you're a Jhumpa Lahiri reader, you have a different perspective. And you see something in the people around you that non-Jhumpa Lahiri readers might not see. And that's what fiction can do in a way that nonfiction can, but often doesn't.
I noticed that in your discussions, you treat the characters in the books like real people. You talk about them like real people. I have a little difficulty with that because I talk to authors and I know how they're created, but you do talk about them as if they actually are people making choices.
Yes, yes. We always talked about the characters as people, and we talked about them almost like relatives, like the way you might talk about a cousin who had made some silly decision or done something wonderful. So when we talked about characters in all sorts of different books. Why did he do that? Why didn't she do that? If only she had done this. And it gave us a richer life. It gave us a lot more people.
But you also have worked with authors, and you know how authors work. Did you ever have to put it back in your mind that, you know, oh, so-and-so, I kind of know why this person put the gun in the handbag, you know?
I was able somehow to completely disconnect my old editorial critical faculty and just enjoy the books we read. And so very divorced from the authors.
You're gay and your sister is as well. That plays very little role in the book, and you treat it very matter-of-factly.
I do. I waited till the very end of the book to tell the story about coming out to mom, my coming out, and my father, I should add. And one of the reasons is it was matter-of-fact in our lives by this point in our lives, and it was important to present it as such. To show a family that loved each other, that was inclusive of my partner of 28 years and of my sisters, and that it's not a big deal in our family. And I tell the story of when it was kind of a big deal only at the very end. I mean, there's somewhere, I think, between the coming out book, which is a wonderful sort of genre book,
yeah.
And then the sort of gay couples book, which seems to be a huge genre book too, and a wonderful genre book. I think there's room and a place for books where gay family members interact with everybody and it's taken for granted. My father's reaction, which he had my mother convey to me, was, "Your father's fine with it, but he's just worried you're going to want to talk about it all the time." So I said, "You can assure Dad it's okay. I have other things to talk to Dad about." But I mean, I don't want to underplay how big a deal it still is in our society. I'm not saying that I think our family was in any way typical. I think we've got an unbelievably long way to go, and there's unbelievable forces of hate arrayed against gay people. So this is an example of a family. I don't think we're anywhere near over this.
What would your mom think of someone like Mitt Romney?
My mother was so crazily passionate about Barack Obama that no one could say a word against Barack Obama, and no one could say a word in favor of anyone running against Barack Obama.
Before we move on to a little bit about publishing and your career, one other question. You read all these people, and you could recommend Hosseini. I mean, there's a lot of people to recommend, but in one interview I read, you singled out Wallace Stegner. Why?
Wallace Stegner was a complete revelation to me. There is a kind of immersive reading experience that I think all readers had when they were 16 or 17, when you discover, for me it was David Copperfield, and the world goes away. And to some degree, I think as you grow up, it's harder to find those immersive reading experiences, those authors who create a world and characters and the quality of their prose and observations. And this book did it for me, Crossing to Safety by Wallace Stegner. And it's not one thing, it's about all sorts of things, the friendship of couples, cancer, death, fate. But that book gave me that experience I hadn't had since I was 16. I've had it in one or two other instances, but it didn't restore my faith because I have a lot of faith, but it just was one of those extraordinary books. For readers, I think it's that trying to regain that experience. Every time you open a book, it's with the hope that this will do to you what those books did to you.
Will Schwalbe, you spent 20 years in the business, and of course it's changed over the years. A couple of questions. You talk a lot in the End of Your Life book club about the pressure you were under. What kind of pressure? Was it coming from your big bosses telling you you've got to make more money? How did that work?
The pressure was really more having to do with the culture of the workplace than the results that were expected of us. And the culture of the workplace had become meetings. And we were in meetings, the jacket meeting at 9, the print meeting at 10, the something meeting at 2. And the meetings eventually became, for me, soul-destroying. And that may be too grandiose a term, but I would sit there thinking, this isn't what I love to do. I love to read books and edit books and promote books, and I don't love sitting in meetings.
Somewhere along the line, it used to be that an editor would find a manuscript, convince people that they should buy it, and then edit it. And somewhere along the line, and I don't know how true this was in where you work, but I understand that there were suddenly editors and acquisition editors.
Editors, acquisition editors. And one of the most pernicious things in publishing is the habit that publishers have, based on budget needs, to schedule books before they're delivered. So you have a big book coming, and you say, we're going to publish it in March, and it's supposed to come in a certain month, and it comes in 3 months later, and it's supposed to be this good, and it's not quite that good. And that's, I think, why a lot of books are published before their time. I was incredibly lucky with my book because my publishing house, Knopf, said, we're not going to schedule it till it's done. It's not going on a schedule till it's finished. But that's the exception, not the rule.
In the old days, a publisher would take on a young author knowing that it would take 3 or 4 books for them to reach maturity. And what I'm seeing instead now is everybody wants tentpole first time out. And what first novel fully works?
Yeah. It's a real problem. I always used to joke that after Shakespeare handed in Troilus and Cressida, someone might have said to him, well, Bill, you know, you had a lot of promise as a young fella, but yeah, this one's not your best effort, and sorry, we're just not going to do any more plays with you. That's the equivalent of what goes on now, that people are expected to knock it out of the park every time, and there's so many wonderful, interesting, flawed books that deserve to be published and deserve to be read. But we have this culture of hyperbole where everything has to be the greatest thing ever written or it's not worth reading.
Well, that also counters the notion which, you know, I've discovered over the time that one author, right, if they're lucky, over the course of a career has one, two, or three great books, but they might be 25 or 30 books. But if they can't get published after the first couple, or if the sales begin to shrink, that second or third book will never arrive.
That's a huge problem. And I hate to think how many books we've lost that way. It's not that you can just expect people to write those books and stick them in a drawer. It's those books need to be published. And the literary culture is poorer for the fact that these second and third and fourth novels are not being published.
What did you do as an editor for 20 years to fight that trend? Did you? Were you able to?
I found that I was very often able to make a commitment to a writer and keep that commitment. It's something I was very proud of. So when I took on an author like Pramudia Anantatur, great Indonesian writer, one of the greatest writers of our time, I think I published 7 or 8 books by Pramudia, including very minor early works that were interesting, that needed to be published. So I really tried to make a commitment to writers that say, I'm not publishing this book, I'm publishing you.
What role do programs like this have? Do they have any real role?
Programs like this have an enormous role. I really believe that because the conversation around books is, I think, as important as the books themselves. And that's one thing that I really want my book to get across is it's not so much that Mom and I read a lot of wonderful books at the same time as she was dying. It's that we read them and we talked about them. And the books sparked all sorts of conversations. And on programs like this on radio, the conversations about books are things that give people meaning, tell them what to do in life, open up new worlds.
E-books have kind of taken over. There's a comment you make in the End of Your Life book club that, you know, people need books on their walls because it's about their lives. And yeah. An e-book in a machine isn't about your life. It's sitting in the book.
I read a lot of books on e-books. I'm a big e-book reader. But when I looked at my mother dying underneath a bookshelf with all her favorite books and saw that she could look over at that and see the books that had taught her and guided her, I realized there's something lost on an e-book. There really is. And I now, when I read an e-book of a book I love, I go and buy a physical copy to keep on my shelf because there's something about your eye catching a physical book or how you can open it and flip to a certain page. It may not be rational, but I love to know when I give someone a book that from my collection that they have something that I read that I loved, that physical thing.
Well, I also know when if I walk into someone's house, I look at their bookshelf.
Yes, exactly.
It tells me something about who they are.
It really, you know, it really does.
I'm not going to say, can I borrow your Kindle?
And it reminds you, you stumble across the books you own, and you don't stumble across the e-books you own.
One thing I've noticed on plane rides and traveling on public transportation is that older people are reading e-books on Kindles. Younger people are still reading books.
Books are, I don't think they're going anywhere. I mean, you have all sorts of LASIK surgeries coming out of your eyes and stuff, but you still see younger people love Warby Parker and wearing glasses. Books are, they're talismanic, extraordinary, beautiful objects. I do think one of the things the publishing industry did that was a big mistake is for years they cheapened the physical book. They did it on worse paper and the bindings weren't as nice. And that, to me, was a huge mistake. But that's being reversed. There are publishers like McSweeney's, like Knopf, who are putting real beauty back into books.
So you see a future for publishing.
I'm very optimistic. I'm very optimistic.
What do you think when someone who's never written a book before, like Lena Dunham, gets $3.5 million for a book she hasn't written yet?
I have actually no problem with that.
Okay.
I don't think that keeps a single other book from being published. Books can be many things, and one of the things they can be is a souvenir of an experience. When I go to the circus, I may well buy the program for $10 because it's a souvenir of my experience at the circus. And I think a lot of these celebrity books are souvenirs of the experience of loving a particular celebrity.
Will Schwalbe, Cookster, you did get it off the ground, and you were involved until, March 2011, then you left.
Yes, I'm still involved. I work on it about an hour a day, but there's a wonderful fellow named Art Chang, college friend who helped me start it, and he's now the CEO. It's solidly break even.
How do you make it break even? I mean, it's free recipes.
It's free recipes. We power recipe search for all sorts of other people. So if you go on Kaiser Permanente's site, Cookster Recipes, the AARP, Cookster Recipes, and it's complicated how we make money, but we do make money that way, and we're very proud of it. I'm very proud of it.
What have you been doing since?
The book. I've been working on the book since I left. I was finishing it up, and I've been trying and very happily engaging with all different kinds of communities of people, communities of readers, communities of people who are interested in end-of-life care and issues revolving around that. And there's such a rich, wonderful world online and so many ways to connect with people.
Have you started working on something else?
I'm playing with some things, but I'm playing with a couple different things. I haven't fixed on what's next yet.
And in terms of your work as an editor, do you miss the actual physical editing, or do you sometimes do freelance editing?
I sometimes do freelance editing. I do maybe a book a year because I love it still.
Well, also, I've noticed that the editing is getting worse and worse.
Sometimes it's getting worse and worse. Sometimes I must say I can call myself a writer now. I hope my fellow writers don't take editing. So you never quite know on a book that was poorly edited, whether some poor editor gave wonderful comments that the writer refused to listen to.
One thing that maybe you have an answer for me, but it was a theory I had about what I used to call bloat books, books that are 500 or 600 pages but really should be 250, and that the reason for that is the computer, because you don't have to keep rewriting or typing a page, and you just keep going.
I think the computer has a lot to do with bloat books. It's a good phrase. I like that. Then again, there were certainly extraordinary bloat books prior to the invention of the computer. Some people are just verbose. But there is a torture to retype an entire manuscript, and that really has kept some people from editing their books as tightly as they needed to be edited.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a little bit of a dirt question because, you know, you're kind of in the industry. Name a few books that were basically created by an editor on the editing floor. We know Catch-22. What else?
I can't. Those secrets, that's part of our professional code. Those will go to the grave with me. I think in some ways it's fear of being thought less of a writer that keeps some writers from taking wonderful editorial comments that are given them. And I think that's why it's part of the editor's code of silence. Because editing is not writing, and a heavily edited book is still the writer's book.
Will Schwalbe, you co-authored a book called Send, Why People Do Email So Badly. And my last question to you is something that I've been struggling over. How the hell do you sign an email? I mean, some people put best, some people put thanks. The one that makes me nauseous is cheers, and then there's hugs. I don't know how to do that.
I have two email signatures that my co-author David Shipley and I came up with. Best is for everyone in the world you don't already have a relationship with, and as ever is for everyone in the world you already have a relationship with. There's something very comforting about as ever. It means whatever you are, you still are.
You've been listening to an interview with Will Schwalbe, whose book is titled The End of Your Life Book Club. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.